season with our Olympics special. We are going to follow up on this story and look at it from perhaps a different point of view than the symbolic one from before. A more hands-on one, down at the floor, so to speak. We have Ben Fellows with us on the program, the G4S Insider. The first spoke out under the name Lee Hazeldine, and we're going to go into detail more on this story here today on Red Ice Radio. I'd like to say thanks to Tony Gosling, of course, as well, for getting us in contact with Ben. First of all, thanks for coming on the program, Ben. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us here today.
No, it's absolutely my pleasure. It's great to be here. I'm really excited.
Absolutely. Now, give us the backstory first. We don't want to leave anybody behind who might not have heard about you or your story before. Can you summarize what you've been doing, what you've seen, and what you've talked about since this whole episode began for you, Ben?
Okay, sure, yeah. Well, I'm a filmmaker and an investigative journalist, and I decided 3 years ago now to go into G4S and join the events team for the Olympics. I've heard many stories whereby people have come to me and told me horror stories, quite frankly, about G4S. One mother said that her son was serving with G4S in Iraq. He'd got drunk at a bar and killed two of his other G4S colleagues. Now, she said that he had post-traumatic stress syndrome from being with the British Army, having served in Iraq just 6 months previously to that. G4S didn't care, and they just re-employed him. So I was interested in joining G4S, but I wasn't sure, quite frankly, where I was going to end up in the business. I didn't want to join them full-time, because obviously I do lots of other things. I'm not a security officer.
Yeah.
So I decided, when I knew that they were handling the Olympics, that to join the events team. And so that's what I did. So I got myself an SIA license, which is a security industry license, which everyone needs to have in this country to be a security officer. And I basically went around doing security work, trying to get my CV up. I was working on weekends. I was working a few evenings in the week. I looked after the Turkish president when he came over for an event. You know, various celebrities and things I'd looked after, also working at nightclubs, because I thought I'd have to have a really good CV to get into G4S.
Mm.
In fact, when I went to the interview, I joined the long line of people in G4S, and I basically just walked in through the door and they weren't interested. So, you know, prior to that, you know, I've done stories on the IRA. I'm actually working on the story about the IRA at the moment, which has been a sort of a long-term project. But I've done stories about the IRA and collusion. I've done stories on gun running when the British police force wanted to be an armed police force. They wanted to have guns themselves. They allowed in a certain amount of weapons to go to various rough estates around the country. And as part of the Cook Report team, which is a television program in the UK, I was part of the team involved with some of those stories and stuff like that. So, and also Cash for Questions, which was about lobbying governments and big corporations paying to get questions asked in the Houses of Parliament, which of course goes against everything that a democracy is about. So, you know, I've been around for a while doing these sort of things. So really, you know, it came as no surprise to me when I needed to take advantage of this, you know, G4S and the Olympic situation. I kind of jumped in with both feet, really. So that's what I did.
So you wanted to go work for the G4S specifically because you wanted to check out the situation surrounding this Olympics and how it was dealt with security-wise? Is that the case?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, you know, a lot of the times when you do these sort of stories, they actually come to nothing because you hear all the horror stories, but then when you actually join the companies, you think, well, maybe it was an isolated incident that happened to that person because actually I'm not finding any evidence of it. So you always join these companies with an open mind. I certainly didn't go to G4S expecting to find what I actually did find, which was, you know, terrifying, really, most of the time. I actually went with an open mind, and I joined the queue along with everybody else on the day that I was there, and I went through the interview process. But I wanted to find out how they were, what the course was that you were going to be doing for training, how that training was going to be handled, who was doing the training, and then obviously work up to the deployment in the Olympics. My intention was always to go and work for G4S for the Olympics because it was a short amount of time. You know, it's what, 4 weeks in total with the Paralympics as well.
Yeah.
So it wasn't going to, it's not a massive commitment for an undercover journalist. It's quite a short period of time. So that's really why I did it.
So tell us about what happened there and the procedure you went through for those who don't know, Ben.
Okay. When I went to the interview, it was like a cattle market. We were basically just moved from room to room. We went to an intranet room where they had their company intranet on computers, and we filled out an application form online, and you put down your references, your work references, your personal references, and the like. And then you were moved to what they called the interview stage. The interview stage, and I'm not kidding, this is exactly what it was, is that a very nice professional woman led me down the corridor, and she showed me to a little cubicle where they had three cups. And she said, can you smell the three cups and tell me what's in them? And so I smelt them. I said, well, that's orange, that's lemonade, and actually that's just an empty cup, it's nothing. And she went, very good. I went, okay. And then she showed me her pad, and on her pad was a number one, a number eight, and a squiggly line that kind of resembled a seven. So I said to her, look, that's one, that's an eight, and that's kind of a squiggly line. And she said, yes, that's very good, it's not a number. And I said, of course it's not a number, I know. That was the end of the interview.
Wow. Oh, boy.
I had all this security training. I've been training for 3 years. I felt like I was one of the Olympic athletes. I was that dedicated to doing this. She didn't want to know about any experience that I had. She said, that's nothing to do with me. I am literally just giving you a smell test and a sight test. And then I was moved on to the next room where I waited for about 20 minutes. And actually, then someone came in and said, okay, you can go home now. We'll be in contact with you. About 2 weeks later, I got an email back saying, congratulations, you're one step closer to your Olympic dream, and gave me my first two dates for training.
Hmm. So nothing about the SIA license that you had to have for this?
No. I took my SIA license. They weren't interested in seeing it. One of the things they're offering people, or were offering people, I should say, was that if you went there without an SIA license whatsoever, they would pay for you to get one. It's part of the Olympic legacy that the government said. So basically, you'd end up at the end of the process with an SIA license. So potentially you could work as a security officer. So they actually weren't interested in seeing your SIA license whatsoever. And this has ramifications later on in the story as well, especially when people were being picked for team leaders and stuff. They didn't want to see that. I then got this email, and that's when I basically turned up for my first 2 days of work. Now, just to sort of say that usually I would actually take covert cameras in to this situation. But the thing was is that my cameras really are, are very small and very good. But, they're easily found. And I was thinking, well, look, I'm in a security role here. I'm going to be searched, maybe even practiced on by a student.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way I'm going to be able to get a security camera into there. And when we went in there, G4S were guarding it. I'd show them the email, they went through, they didn't search you at the gate, they didn't look at your bag, and then you'd walk into the training areas and stuff like that. And in actual fact, they were very paranoid about people taking photos or having dictaphones out or anything like that. There was absolutely no way I could have actually filmed this. So just to let people know, that's why I didn't do that, but usually mm-hmm. I'm frightened.
Yeah. No, and so how does this proceed? When are we now date-wise here, Ben?
We're in April, May time by the time training has rolled around. And my first two training days were called Basics of Security or Security Skills, Basics, I think. Basic Security Skills, something like that. And basically, for the first day, we were told about the Olympic mascots. And that's pretty much it. And when the Olympics had taken place in previous years in London. And that happened all day. And I was thinking, well, when's the security bit going to kick in? And it never did. I mean, literally, they spanned the whole day out talking about the mascots, talking about when the Olympics was here. And stuff like
that. What did they say about the mascots, by the way?
they didn't actually answer my question, which was, why have they only got one eye?
Right, I was going to ask you about that. Yeah, right.
Yeah, I said to them, look, to me, these are pretty creepy. Why have they got one eye? And the guy said, because they have. And that was it. Right?
Yeah.
They were, the trouble is with the trainers, what they were doing is that they were reading from a script. And if it wasn't on their script, they couldn't answer the question. I asked quite a lot of questions when I was there. I kind of got known as the kind of the questions guy, right? And I'd walk past rooms at other times, and I'd see trainers saying exactly the same thing I'd just heard in another class. So, you could say they were just running off the script, really. And then really, it was kind of like the basic introduction to security. you know, this is what you do. You search people, you search their bags, you do, you know, and that's it. You may search their car. And that was it. There was actually no in-depth discussions whatsoever. I mean, when I did my SIA license, what, 3 years ago, it was, I actually found it quite taxing. It was quite hard. And that was just to get a general SIA license. And the exam that you had to do, I had to actually study for it. I thought it was just going to be a doddle. And in actual fact, I found myself revising, which I hadn't had to do since I was at college. So, you know, but for this, this is the Olympics. This is the, you know, the greatest show on earth. Nothing.
Yeah.
Didn't see anything about stuff.
Now, tell us a little bit about what you think that this, obviously I want you to continue the story and proceed ahead here, what's happened consequently where we are now in this situation and what you've learned and stuff, but I wanted to ask you what, up front, what does this mean to you? Why is why is this so sloppy?
Well, they're sloppy because they're there to steal £300 million, quite frankly. They had no intention of delivering the security for the Olympics, I believe. If they did, they wouldn't have decided to start trying to recruit 10,000 people, 10,400 people, sorry, in January. Everybody knows, if you just think about how many people that is a month you've got to see, and you've got to see them, what, four or five times for training days, you can't do it. It's impossible. The maths just doesn't work. So everybody knew that really, you know, 10,400 people from January was impossible. The government knew it was impossible. Theresa May, last year, was in contact with G4S and was worried about G4S and about the training. And basically G4S went, no, it's all right, it's fine, apparently. But the government were worried. They thought they couldn't recruit enough staff back in last year. So, you know, really, you know, G4S have got away with, you know, their original contract was for £84 million. And then they upped it by £284 million. And then just last week when we broke the story with on Tony Gosling's show, their management fee went from £7.5 million, and this is just for the managers, just the managers of G4S. LOCOG gave them a further £50 million. And I was told when it happened, on the morning of when it happened, I was told in advance that this was going to happen, and it happened, that this was to weather the storm. And isn't it funny that now G4S have come out and said, actually, it's going to cost us about $50 million to deal with this, except they were just given it by LOCOG. So, you know, they're all in cahoots with each other, really. And I just think it was about stealing money. They say that, you know, they need 3,500 troops. I know for a fact, because I've got a senior manager of G4S who's in these meetings that are taking place, who's calling me and telling me the 9,000 people short. 9,000 people short.
Mm.
That only employed about 1,600 people at best. I mean, this is insane. It's crazy. It's just about stealing people's money. And this is our money. Londoners have paid for this Olympics. The people of Great Britain have paid for these things. We keep getting told, it's our Olympics. Enjoy it. And, you know, how can we when LOCOG is allowing other companies to basically just steal money? I mean, even Nick Buckles apparently is going to be gone by the end of the week. He's the CEO of Group 4, G4S, and they're working on his resignation as we speak, and he will walk away with an estimated £21 million pay packet. He already gets £830,000. He's got a shares package of around £11 million, you know, in total, when you include everything. And he's got an £8.7 million pension pot. So he's going to walk away with £21 million. No wonder the guy's not bothered.
Wow. That's just crazy. I mean, this opens up for a lot of possibilities. I want to discuss those with you a little bit later on as well. But, I mean, G4S, as I like to call them, is the world's the third largest private sector employer in the world. So they're a huge company, Ben, obviously.
Yeah, and funny enough, when I was doing Cash for Questions, we came across, they were called Group 4 then. That's why I keep calling them Group 4, because I knew them as Group 4 for years. Ken Clark, Justice Minister now, had a lot to do with pushing them into becoming G4S, helping them to acquire companies and stuff like that. And I think, don't quote me on this, that he might have been a non-executive director of the company at that point. I don't think he is anymore, but I think he certainly was then.
Mm-hmm.
He told me personally, and this is, you know, from him to me, you know, so he said, you know why they we called it Group 4? And I said, no. And he says, because the four's the dollar sign on the keyboard.
Well, there you go. Interesting. Well, it seems to be that in this case. So what? So this, I want to ask a little bit more before we proceed to what you've learned consequently. I had a few comments on the shows you've done, obviously, Ben, before, the aspects of what they actually told you, and maybe we can just run that through, and also when that was and what has happened consequently, but just proceed in the timeline, if you will, Ben.
Sure. So I'm actually at the training in Stratford in East London. We can see the stadium and everything from where we are. And basically, you've got a PowerPoint presentation every day. Just to make this clear, I've only done 4 days worth of training. I was assigned to a pedestrian screening area, which is searching people. X-raying their bags, so I'm an X-ray operator as well, and I'll come to that in a minute, of how I was trained for that, which is crazy, having never done it before. So really, I couldn't be in a more sort of important position within the security environment. I'm not on a back gate or anything. I'm not just standing around and telling people, giving them directions or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm searching people. I'm looking for things. They're more interested in telling us, and this was, this was day one. They said about, bombs being in the stadium on day one. They said, look, if there is a bomb, if they are going to blow up the Olympics, they said, don't worry, because it's probably, it's already factored into the infrastructure of the stadium. It's already built in. And I was like, oh, that's, why say that? Now you've scared me. I was listening to all this, and I was just going, now I'm worried, and a lot of people were just sitting there, and this was just washing over them, and I to various people during my time, and, when they mentioned things, I'd say, aren't you worried about that? And they'd say, oh, well, now you've said that, yeah, it's a bit scary, isn't it? But they were talking so much, they were saying so many, giving you so much information. Really, a lot of it was kind of, it was a bombardment. It was almost like, somebody giving you a big sales pitch, and they were speaking so fast, and so for so long, that really, after a while, everyone just tuned out,
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people there, didn't speak English, and they've been criticised as well. And it's not their fault that they don't speak English. Job centres in this country are forcing everybody to go for jobs in the Olympics to keep their benefits. So instead of offering these people an ESOL class, which is, an English class to learn English, they've just been told to go to the Olympics. They don't know why they're there.
Wow.
And then, while they're there, instead of saying, sorry, this is not for you, says, come on in. Because they have a policy, and this is fact, straight from my senior manager C4S, that they have a no-fail policy. In other words, everybody who's on that course, regardless of whether they speak English, regardless of whether they can do the job or not, everybody passes the courses. I was doing a bag search, and because I've been security before, I know exactly how to do a bag search and how detailed that bag search needs to be. And I looked across to my right, and I saw another gentleman doing a bag search, and he just looked at the bag and held it. And the trainer looked at him and said, "It's all right, mate. I know what you mean." I said, "Well, hold on a minute. He hasn't done anything. I don't know what he means." And the trainer just turned to me and just said, "Oh, mind your own business." And I went, "Oh, that's how it's going to be, is it?"
Wow. So this means incompetence as the end result, of course. I can't help to think maybe on one level that this is what they're looking for, Ben, as some people have speculated. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I was at the start of all this, when I went into G4S, I was basically going to think, well, they're probably going to be a bit sloppy. But in actual fact, by the time I was actually looking at these courses, by the time I'd heard everything, I actually thought, this isn't incompetence. This is what they want, They want people who can't speak English. They want people who are incompetent, I didn't really, I hadn't put all the dots together at that point, so I was just kind of going through the process. But, you know, when they're telling you about the evacuation of London and that you are going to be involved in the evacuation of London, and in actual fact, G4S staff will be dealing with the public, that will be your job, in the event of something happening and you know, a big terrorist attack and we have to evacuate London, then you would be involved in that. And I thought, well, hold on a minute. You've not told me about the evacuation of the stadium, but you're spending hours and hours and hours on the evacuation of London and showing us drones attacking people in Afghanistan, because obviously they said they're going to have drones flying above us as well. You know, this was just scary, a lot of it was. So you kind of go from being the mundane, which wasn't really, you know, telling you anything, because, you know, they put up an example. They put up like a one of their PowerPoint presentations, and they put up five faces. And they said, you know, who's the terrorist? Well, all of them were, other than the policeman, of course. and that's the story.
Yeah.
But, you know, I kind of said, you know, all of them. And obviously, because I got it right, they gave me a dirty look if I'd blow the next few pages off the PowerPoint. All of them, you know.
Wow.
But, so go from that to going to, by the way, you know, the Olympics is so big and everything, they've had to get in 200,000 casket linings. And I said, well, what's a casket lining? I didn't have a clue what that was. And they said, oh, it's a plastic coffin that can fit four people in. So I said, so you're preparing for 800,000 people then, or up to that. And the guy just stared at me. He glared at me, you know.
Wow.
And these are literally guys, you know, these are all guys that have served in Afghanistan and Iraq, you know, they go from being in the British Army into G4S, and these were the trainers, and all Army people and stuff, and he glared at me, you know, and I thought, oh, right, I've obviously stepped over the mark again.
Wow. Now, what is the reasoning for some of this stuff? I mean, and what level, what is your sense of it when they're talking about this? Do they have, is there any indication that these people are in the know-how, or are they using all of this as precautions because they want to be safe if whatever happens, so they have an infrastructure there to deal with it? Or what's the reasoning, do you think?
Well, you know, yes, you know, that is part of it, obviously, because obviously, you know, you have to, with security, they're always kind of talking about the worst possible outcomes.
Right.
That's kind of what security people do. They're over-paranoid because they have to be, you know, in their job, they are responsible for you know, protecting all of us. In that matter, when something goes wrong, we all blame them, you know, and they know it. So security people in general are always overcautious. So that has something to do with it. There are plans in place, obviously. But why? My question was, why did we have to know about them? And, you know, I didn't need to know that, you know, there was an evacuation of London in place. They could have just said, you know what, there are procedures in place if something goes wrong. And you know what? You'll be informed. You know, if something happens, you'll be informed by your team leader, and the team leader will be informed by the group leader, and so on and so forth.
Mm.
I feel that they have to go into detail, but they were going into detail. They went into detail about the evacuation of London. They also said in the same conversation that London was going to experience a defining moment in the history of London. And I said, well, what does that mean? And she said, well, I can't really tell you, but the great thing is you're all going to have a role in it. And I thought, well, hold on a minute, let's get this clear. Do you mean, you know, because sometimes people split up the Olympics and the Paralympics. I never do, but often people do.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, so are you talking about the Paralympics? And this was a woman called Tanya, and she said, no, this is something else. But it's great, you're all going to have jobs. And everyone kind of clapped at that point because they heard the word, you're all going to have a job. And they all went, yeah, great. And I was like, no, this is bad. What do you mean?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So the only one asking questions at this stage is you. Now, what do you feel is the emphasis here, and how much does these trainers know about this, do you think? Really? I mean, the evacuation of London, a defining moment. I mean, that's pretty big stuff, right?
Yeah, these people are, these trainers, just reading from a script, they're on a need-to-know basis themselves. They're army people. You don't tell army people anything. You tell them, look, this is what you say. And don't forget that they had, you know, well, they claim to have had 800 people going to that training center every day. So I'm not somebody special who's, they've said this just to me. They were saying this to everybody.
Yeah.
And people going through. And in actual fact, other people have subsequently come out and said, yes, this is what they've said, and picked on some of the other things that I've said. And it's been proven right, of course, because, you know, lots of people have heard all this stuff. So, you know, why were they telling us? Because they wanted to prepare us, I thought, for this defining moment in the history of London, you know, and it scared me, and it really did. And I'm not saying that just to be, you know, over dramatic, you know, and stuff like that. I'm not really that kind of person, quite frankly, you know. But, you know, when you start talking about, you know, 200,000 casket linings, you know, a defining moment in the history of London, and they're not telling you what any of this is, what it means, yeah?
Yeah.
I just, well, hold on, you're using my imagination against me now, yeah? I don't like it when people do that. It's like when the news does it to you, they, you know, and then, you know, often, more often than not, these things do actually end up happening, you know?
Yeah. Now, consequently, have you asked around more about this, Ben, what this means, if anybody knows anything more about this?
Well, no, because everybody, you know, I was outed, was it last week, by a Channel 4 Home Affairs correspondent called Andy Davis, and he outed me to G4S. So from that moment on, that's why I was Lee Hazelding, you see, because I was undercover, I was still working within the organisation, you know, I was still waiting for my next to be deployed, in actual fact.
Yeah.
And I brought the story to him to run with, and he told me that he wouldn't be, he's not interested, Channel 4's not interested. In actual fact, there's a blackout on doing anything negative with the Olympics. Actually, up until that point, there hadn't really been anything negative. There were no negative stories. They did some sort of puff pieces where they pretended to ask the hard question of, are you going to be ready to G4S? And G4S just said, yeah. And they went, okay, great, thanks, fine. So, you know, that's basically all that had happened. They actually hadn't focused on any of the problems. And when whistleblowers had come out, there was a girl who lived in the north of England who worked part of the administration team who was looking at applications. And she said, look, you know, these applications are strewn all over the floor. There's thousands of people everywhere. We don't know what we're doing. And she came out to the press and they printed the story in her local press, but none of the major media organisations, you know, the TV organisations, news, picked up on it at all. So, you know, I kind of went, well, okay, that's true then. Obviously, there is some sort of blackout. And when they talk about media blackout, it's not like, you know, the government sends a D notice, which means disappear that item. It's a suggestion. It's you get. I mean, I've worked in, you know, newsrooms. I've worked in central television and various other newsrooms and stuff. And what they tend to do is they give you a phone call and they suggest to you not to do certain stories because it would be bad, you know, for the government. And so really, the worst kind of censorship is self-censorship. And this is what happens in every newsroom up and down the country, including the BBC. You know, in actual fact, all that the BBC do is that they take whatever the government spews out, they put it into their own words, and they just send it back out again. They actually don't really do anything.
Yeah.
There's no journalism or anything, you know.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be one of many investigative journalists who had got into the Olympics. But sadly, I'm the only person who had the foresight in doing this. Now, there's something wrong with the British press, isn't there, if I'm the only person who's been able to get in there to do something.
That's right. Now, but we need to touch upon this as well, though, because you brought this to my attention. From Sky News, whistleblowers Olympic security warning, new article. This was on the 13th of last Friday here. There's no name mentioned in it, but basically it's you know, restating what you already had said, but they have not been in contact with you. What's this all about, do you think?
Well, I had a phone call from Lou Collins from the Lou Collins radio show, and she said, have you just appeared on Sky TV? And I said, no, I haven't even talked to Sky TV. Anyway, she sent me the link. I looked at the article and what have you. It was my words. It was almost my words, you know, pretty much what I had said on the Tony Gosling show. And the various other people had interviewed me. And, you know, I was like, well, hold on a minute. I'm amazed. This so-called anonymous trainer within G4S is basically saying exactly the same thing. Well, I mean, almost word for word. You know, there was a few discrepancies here and there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he said to a student to put a 9mm gun down their sock and walk through the metal detector. Well, you know, anybody knows who's got any experience with guns that 9mm gun is a big, heavy object, really. You can't stick it down your sock. You may have been able to put it down your belt or something, but not in your sock. It was, you know, it's a crazy idea. So we read this, and then half of me said, well, hey, that's great. You're being vindicated, you know. But then the suspicious side of me just said, hold on a minute. It looks like G4S are trying to do damage control by getting Sky to put her story out, anonymous whistleblower. So in other words, they can overpower me because obviously they're Sky and they can have control over all, you know, lots of different things. They can put up more stuff about their whistleblower than the actual real whistleblower who's actually really telling people real things. Try and bury the story. And actually, I don't think they've actually run a story since on this, even though the BBC have been running a story every single day, because more and more revelations are now coming out, and we're actually forcing the government to do things. We're forcing the major media to do things. However, no one's talking to me. And no one's acknowledged that it was me and Tony Gosling who broke the story in the first place. There's shenanigans afoot. We've actually proven, I was speaking to Tony earlier this evening, we've proven with this story that we no longer have democracy in our country. We no longer have a free press. Because they didn't report this, because there seems to be a blackout on me and Tony, also struggling as well, we've proven that, you know, G4S, a major corporation, has more control over the government than we do as citizens who basically, you know, employ the government. So, you know, we've proven this idea of corporations being bigger than government and stuff like that. And it's really time that people sort of, you know, started to wake up, especially in our country, in London and in the UK. But really, you don't have a free press. All they're doing is regurgitating the government line. And you're not actually having any dissenting voices whatsoever. What we're on now, this is the media. This is the only place where you're actually getting conversation and debate. And real news going on. It's crazy.
It is completely crazy, considering so how many outlets there are out there and how conformed they are just to the one line. It's absolutely amazing. Now, there have been a number of articles that, searching around today. The Independent seems to have actually published quite a bit on this now. The security is turning out to be quite a debacle at this stage, it seems like. G4S is being criticized now. They are recently here repeatedly assured ministers that they would overshoot Olympic security targets. There was an extra, 3,500 troops that were called in here? What is this all about, do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a shambles. Again, it fits into my theory that they were never intending to supply security officers. This 3,500 troops, I mean, you know, the reality is that G4S are 9,000 people short of their target. And so the military is going to have to take over all of the security operations, the front of house security operations I'm talking about, because they already have their role already allocated to them, and obviously with the police special services and the intelligence services as well. So I'm not talking about any of that. All I'm talking about is the G4S front of house security. And the army are going to have to take over it all, because they said that they had 4,000 people that they've already deployed. And I said, well, actually, you haven't deployed them, you're waiting to deploy them, and those people are the people that already worked for G4S. You know, they do the football on Saturday, they do other sporting events, they've just done Wimbledon. And so, you know, what's happening is that, you know, I'm saying things on shows like yours, and then 2 days later, mainstream media are sort of taking what I've said, regurgitating it, but not admitting that we've said it, and then putting it out as the line, or G4S are having to admit things and what have you.
So is this a real, an honest reaction to some of the criticism that you've had? Or because, again, I as you say, I haven't still seen in the articles I've read about this, where there's a reference how this was found out, or why, you know, these targets that they had haven't been met at this stage.
Yeah, because, you know what, I was told very early on that I'm the guy who ruined the Olympics. And I said, anything. G4S have ruined the Olympics for everybody. If they were a great company, what could I have said? Nothing. You know, this would be a story. And it isn't. Because there's been this media blackout, and clearly there is a media blackout on me as well now, that they can't admit where they're getting their stories from. So they're basically just writing the story and hoping that we don't ask too many questions, because they're getting it from me. This is what I've been saying. Nothing that they have written has appeared anywhere else. It's all come from me, and Tony. So this is a reaction to it, because the government are having to play catch-up. They knew that G4S weren't capable of doing this, and I think they knew they had to bring in the army a long time ago. I mean, these soldiers have just been in Afghanistan. You know, they're fighting, you know, a war there, and then they're on a plane. 2 days later, they're in the Olympics saying, this way to the toilets, and, you know, can I check your tickets, please? I mean, come on, these people should be home with their families.
Yeah.
And I'm saying all this stuff, and I'm, you know, quite frankly, I'm embarrassing Bucharest, which I'm very happy about, and I'm embarrassing the government, which again I'm very happy about doing, because people aren't doing their jobs, the government aren't doing their jobs, you know. But you know, Bucharest are going to get away with stealing £300 million. You know, this is insane. It's ridiculous.
Now there's a big risk here. We're going to touch upon this, of incompetence being blamed if. Ben, if there is something going down in London during the Olympics, a real quote-unquote terrorist attack, a false flag one, whatever happens, again, incompetence could be what they're going to blame this on, and consequently, G4S is just going to be ousted at having done a bad job at that stage. And even interesting enough, I mentioned this to you before the program as well, there's been a dive by as much as 10% right now of the shares for G4S. Because of the security debacle here. If that continues to go down, if something happens here, I don't know, this is speculation, of course, as always, but that could that be an indicator for something, that something might be in the works? What do you think?
Well, I certainly think so beforehand, before I came out with the story, yeah. You know, whether it's a false flag or whether it's, you know, a real terrorist action, and quite frankly, you know, I've been in this game a long time, and the amount of actual real terrorist action that's actually been, I could count on, you know, one hand, you know, it takes a couple of fingers, you know.
Yeah.
That most of what actually happens is false flag stuff. However, having said that, the damage is always the same. It's always us being blown up or killed, you know, for whatever political aims the government is trying to push through. So, yes, I think before I outed the story, yes, I think something was probably going to happen at the Olympics, and yes, they've already said that Sebastian Coe, Lord Coe, came on the radio, on Radio 5 Live the other day, and said, well, you know, it's the people of, you know, it was the security officers who we were trying to train. They were untrainable, and, you know, they never turned up for work. Well, hold on a minute, they're not untrainable at all. The training was, you know, stupid.
Insufficient, yeah.
You know, so they were definitely setting people up. I mean, people have got onto the Olympic Park without accreditation in the past couple of days, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think, you know, before we were doing this, I think definitely something was going to go down, something was going to happen. Now, I'm actually not quite sure, because, you know, we're all talking about it. We've managed to get it into the mainstream. It doesn't really matter that, you know, we're not being recognised. That's not what's important. What's important is that we're all talking about it without G4S. We're affecting their bottom line, you know, their money. That's great. You know, they might get away with $300 million, but, you know, 10% of your share price, that's a lot of money you've just lost, actually. So we're discussing these things, and time again, it's shown that when these people get brought out into the light, you know, it does manage to stop whatever false flag operation they were going to do, because obviously everyone knows about it now. So if something were to happen, they'd say, well, it isn't a false flag, actually, it's the government, because look what's happened. You know, I've been told, you know, this week, today, in fact, that Nick Buckles, the CEO, is working on his resignation speech.
Yeah.
And John Connolly, who's the chairman of G4S, has basically said, look, you're going to be gone by the end of the week. There's a common select committee tomorrow where Keith Vaz, MP, is going to talk to Nick Buckles, and I think, you know, he's going to handle himself pretty well at that. And again, that's a charade, because I wrote to Keith Vaz last week, and to another MP, and, you know, I've not heard anything. It's like, well, hold on a minute, I'm the guy who blew the whistle on this stuff. Surely you'd want to know more information about what it was actually like, and so you can put these allegations to Nick Buckles directly.
Yeah.
No, they don't want to know. I mean, the BBC wanted to interview me a couple of weeks ago, and a guy called Gareth Furby, who is a London news correspondent, basically contacted me and said, look, I want to interview you. And, like, is that the same way as you guys did and everyone else? I said, yeah. And he said, do you have any ground rules? And again, like I said to everybody, no ground rules, you can ask me whatever you like. Well, and then I also suggested that he have Ian Horstman-Sewell on, who is the global events MD of G4S. And I said, that might make a better program. I'm a producer and a director. I make things. You know, I know what's going to be good for the program.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that might be good, so I could put my allegations directly to him. Well, of course, he wasn't going to appear on the program. Boris Johnson, the mayor, wasn't going to appear on the program. And then they shelved the interview. They weren't interested. You know, so, you know, this has been a theme running throughout, you know.
Well, I mean, think about it. What could be bigger, really, considering so many things have happened in the past, even in London, of course. We go back to 2005. This would be a major story. Is there something wrong with the security? We really have to check into this. Or again, Ben, is there a possibility here that just what you said previously, the point here is to get as much military personnel into London as possible for some reason? Could that be the case?
Yeah, definitely. That is part of it. Before I actually started at doing the training, I spoke to an army doctor who's actually he'd been moved from his base and was moved to Woolwich Barracks, which is in southeast London, not too far away from Stratford. And he told me, and this guy is a military guy. He's straight up, he's solid. And he was concerned because he said, "Look, I'm having to see all these foreign troops that are coming into London." And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" He says, "Well, they land by Chinook helicopter at Woolwich Barracks, or near to Woolwich Barracks anyway, and then they get, you know, a medical, and then they obviously go on and they get reassigned and they get shipped out to whichever part of London they're going to be, you know, posted at." And so the thing is that we were told that would be 100,000 troops coming in through Woolwich Barracks over the 6-month period running up to the Olympics. Now, I've heard these Chinook helicopter flights happening late at night. They tend to start around about 11 o'clock at night and go on to about 3 o'clock in the morning. And there's, you know, sometimes 4 flights a night. So we've been hearing this going on. And he said, "Look, you know, there's 100,000 troops." And he says, "And people that I've been seeing, you know, have been Americans and have been Germans." And he says, "And maybe, you know, some other nationalities as well," but he couldn't actually say where they were from. You know, maybe like, you know, some Eastern European countries or something. But he definitely had the feeling that these were UN troops. Now, he was concerned. Now, that's somebody in the British Army now talking to me. Now, he knew that I was going to work at the Olympics. He didn't know in what capacity. He didn't know that I was an undercover journalist, just to make that clear. And he actually thought that I was doing something more important than actually just being a security officer, because he'd actually overheard a conversation I was having with somebody else that was about the Joint Terrorist Analysis Centre, which is called JTAC, which actually, you know, do the threat level in this country and look at all terrorist actions. So he thought that I might know something more. So, you know, not to get him in trouble or anything, he actually thought he was, you know, he imparted information to me that I was actually concerned and worried about, and that was the guy in the British Army, you know?
Wow. So, that's a lot of troops as well, Ben. What were they? Are they just stationed there all day, and how long, and or are they out and about, or what?
Yes, some are out and about. You see them in Greenwich. There's certainly troops in uniforms now on the streets of Greenwich, London. These people were coming in through Woolwich Barracks. They were having a medical. They were then given their orders, maybe next day or something, whatever it was. And then they were then shipped out, whichever. He said they were being posted at barracks all around London. And we know there's barracks all around London and in London and this, that and the other. So, you know, I guess that these people are just, you know, there could be quite a legitimate training exercise going on at the same time as the Olympics. We know that during 9/11 there was a training exercise going on, which is why they couldn't scramble the jets in time, because they had all these objects on their screens, didn't they? And they didn't know which objects were the false objects, which was part of the exercise, and which were the real planes going into real buildings. And in actual fact, in one of the things that I've seen, you actually have an air traffic controller, who is a military air traffic controller, say, you know, "Is this real world or is this exercise?"
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so this actually could just be the case whereby there isn't, you know, an exercise going on, which again would point into the direction of possibly a false flag, because they're getting all the troops on the ground. They've got them all here. They think they're here for a training exercise. You know, in actual fact, they're here because something really is going to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, in 2005, when they did the announcement that London would have the Olympics, and by the way, London was always going to have the Olympics. It never wasn't going to be in London. It's too important.
I believe you're right. Yeah.
Yeah. For other reasons, I can't be going to think I'll be here forever. But when they announced it, the next day, so-called terrorists blew up these, you know, the two trains and the bus.
Yeah.
Well, going alongside that was a training exercise. And the guy who was running the training exercise for the police said, "Well, you know, I was, you know, amazed that we had everything ready, because we were practicing at those same tube stations to have, you know, the two trains and a road vehicle blow up in a terrorist attack." you know, so again, another training exercise is going on coincidentally at the same time. So again, it does all point towards a false flag situation with the Olympics. And I said to people, I said, look, you know, I did an interview for a student magazine the other day where they were saying, you know, should students basically go and get jobs during the summer? I said, sure, get a job, anything, doing anything but working at the Olympics. It's not safe. It's not safe because you're going to be rushed through training. And, you know, we didn't have good enough training. You're certainly not going to have good enough training. The people around you aren't going to have good enough training. So therefore, again, as I said originally, a terrorist could basically just queue up and walk through your PSA. You know, yeah, this is dangerous stuff. Or maybe even someone has a heart attack because they've been standing up all day. You're not going to have medical training. You're just going to have to look at them. You're not going to have to do anything. And if something like that happens, that's going to be on the conscience of you for the rest of your life. And I would have nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
And the government says, actually it was the Labour opposition said, well, you know, if we're going to have all these troops, then at least what we can do is give their families tickets to the Olympics. And I immediately said, hey, look, you know, if these are soldiers' families, stay away. You know,
mm-hmm.
The last thing that's going to happen is that, okay, maybe the soldiers don't have a choice because they're ordered to, but if there is a false flag that happens, okay, the soldiers will get killed, but then so will their families. I mean, that would be just awful. So, you know, I would stay away. I don't have tickets to the Olympics. Everyone I know who knows me has actually given their tickets back to Lokov because they don't want to go now because they all feel that it's unsafe as well.
Really? Wow. Well, you would know you were on the inside there and seen some of this stuff. Now, do you? I have so many more questions I want to ask you. So I hope we can carry on a little bit more here. But do you regret that you? Well, you weren't a cover at the time you spoke out, of course, but was there anything indicating to you afterwards that I should have stayed cool for a little bit longer, learned more to actually have more to tell about? Or did you feel at the time that, nah, this is pretty much how far we're going to go with the training debacle and everything else, so this is the right time to speak out?
No. I mean, in a way, it was good that I came out 4 weeks, I think it was nearly 4 weeks, before the Olympics because, you know, when I decided to come out, I thought, well, at least I can do something about it. In actual fact, my intention was to stay into the Olympics and work it and actually and see what it was like, you know, working those PSAs and operating X-ray machines and what have you. But Andy Davis, the Home Affairs correspondent at Channel 4, as I said earlier, I went to him to run the story. He didn't want to do it. He told me there's a press blackout. And what he did do was that he called me up. I contacted him June 13th, and then he called me up when I was on the Tony Gosling show a couple of days, maybe a week later, and he said, look, I'm not happy that you've mentioned my name. And I said, well, look, hold on a minute. You said those things, you know, to me. And he said, yeah, but what I need you to do, because I think he got in trouble, because his name was the only one that people knew. So G4S couldn't get me because they didn't know who I was. So they read the articles and they saw what was online and said, oh, Andy Davis said this. So they got to him, and he said, I need you to retract it. And I said, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to retract the things that you've said, because, you know, you said those things. It would make me look like a liar, and I'm not going to do that. And then what he proceeded to do, and I've got the conversation recorded, you know, if people want to contact me, they can. I'll certainly give you access to it. You know, I've got nothing to hide. I don't come off too well, because obviously I'm very shocked, but he tried to, like, bribe me, which I couldn't believe. He kind of said that, you know, there'd be sort of like a future for me with it, you know, in Channel 4, he'd look at the story in more detail, you know, mm-hmm. he'd have producers do something, you know, in other words, he made it sound like I'd be involved in Channel 4 news a lot more than that. Yeah. I just laughed at the guy and just said, you know, this is crazy. I said, you know, are you really trying to bribe me, Andy? And in actual fact, I told him to get off the phone several times because I actually thought that he was, because I was recording the conversation at this point. Because when he called up, I knew something was wrong by the tone of his voice, so I decided to record it. So, you know, I actually just started saying, well, you know, this is crazy, you should get off the phone, because you know what, you're going to actually start damaging your own reputation. And he said, oh, don't worry about my reputation, I mean, these people are so arrogant, it's untrue, you know, and that annoyed me anyway.
Yeah.
You know, I'm glad that I outed him. I'm glad now that he's been sidelined within Channel 4, which is what, you know, another insider told me. You know, I've got a long history with Channel 4. I mean, people are trying to make out that I'm some sort of documentarian making a conspiracy documentary about conspiracy theories or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's not the case. I do have a history with Channel 4. Channel 4 paid for me to go to the London Film School, along with Mike Lee, the filmmaker. I had a lot of problems with them, and I had to make a lot of complaints, and it all went a bit south, and I ended up was basically going to take them to court and sue them. In actual fact, they decided to settle out of court. So, you know, if they really want to get into things, I can get into that. I suspect Channel 4 don't. So, you know, I'm certainly not working for Channel 4. Channel 4 hate me. But that's why I had to come out, because, sorry, I digressed a little bit there.
That's fine.
I had to come out because Andy Davis actually told G4S, one of the managers in there, who was speaking to him, this Ian Horson Sewell guy, that actually my name is Ben Fellows and this is what I was doing and blah, blah, blah. So I felt all of a sudden, I felt like I was in danger, that if I actually had just wandered back into G4S the next day, for example, that I would be led into a room. And these are military guys. You know, I'm not a military guy. I've had no military training. I'm not, you know, somebody who's gung-ho or anything like that.
Sure.
You know, hate violence, you know, all that kind of stuff. I did not want to have these military guys, even if they were just going to shout at me or something. I didn't know what they were going to do. I actually felt scared at that, because what happened is that a colleague, regardless of whether we had a difference of opinion, you know, that's fine, that's okay. We had an argument, that's fine to have. But what you don't do as journalists, and you know, I have a press pass. You know, I'm not somebody who doesn't have a press pass. I'm fully accredited. You don't, if they're undercover, you don't out them. You don't burn them to the organisation that they're doing it with. That is dangerous. That's how people, in a lot of journalists in Northern Ireland, actually got themselves killed.
Mm-hmm.
People outing them.
Yeah.
Not only within their organisation, but people they knew, and they had various, you know, things. So, you know, that can get you killed. And suddenly I got very, very scared. And, you know, I took advice from other people, and basically went for the decision of saying, well, look, I better out myself now. You know, I can't stay undercover as Lee Hazeldine. They know who I am. They're going to find my, you know, they're going to find me. You know, this is crazy.
Yeah.
And so I asked myself there. And then, but I would have stayed in, you know, obviously to pass the Olympics, you know. That was my intention. In actual fact, it's worked out better because, you know, even though they tried to, you know, look, I've had people sitting outside my house since I've had this. I've been followed. I've had people in a G4S car pull up and threaten me through the window.
Really?
And I said, you're in a G4S car. You're in one of your security vehicles.
Oh, boy. Now, have you, what has the consequent contact been here? You, at this stage, I guess, consider you've been ousted by them, by the G4S. You have no more tasks with them. You can't go back, obviously, I guess. But when was the last official contact with them?
Well, the last official contact was, I think, 2 days ago, when they kept sending me another email about picking up my accreditation.
Yeah.
In actual fact, I'd received an email also from G4S about my schedule. And when I looked at it, I went, oh, this isn't my schedule. This is somebody else's schedule, a guy called Robert Fee. Robert Fee is obviously a security officer, but they'd sent me his schedule. So I knew where he was working, but I didn't know where I would be working. You know? They're still sending me emails and stuff because what the management know isn't what the various departments know. It's like, you know, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing.
Yeah, very compartmentalized, the whole structure there. It's so big as well, so yeah, definitely.
Part of me, you know, is kind of daring myself. Should I go in and take my accreditation?
Could it be worth it?
I'm flagged up on the computer. So I'd get into the building, I'd ask for accreditation, and I'd probably be told to sit there and wait for a minute, and then G4S thugs would come and get me or something.
Yeah. Now, considering what you have done, though, is that in violation of anything that you agreed to or anything like that with them?
No paperwork to say that I'm not a journalist, that I wouldn't talk to any media or anything like that.
Yeah.
You know. I haven't been sent an employment contract or anything like that. So, you know, I'm not in violation of anything, you know.
Yeah.
All that happened is that I've gone through the training and I've told my story. I mean, just to say that when I was, you know, x-ray operators, it's probably the most important job in the pedestrian screening area. You know, when you go to an airport, you have to walk through the metal detector, but you also have to put your bag onto the
X-ray
and go through the metal detectors. That setup is exactly the same setup that we've got in the Olympics. And there's loads of them. Now, at the Olympic Stadium, where I'd be working, I was going to be an X-ray operator. Now, I had basically at the PowerPoint presentation for a day, which told you about what an X-ray operator does, and then the next day, I basically had a go on a computer for a couple of hours of basically the simulation where sort of, you know, a pretend conveyor belt went on top of the screen, a little computer animation, and you had to see a gun or a knife, and they were there, hole in the bag or anything. And then I had half a day of actually operating the machine and in the mock-up PSA that they had. And the thing was, is that, you know, if I had half a day, that, you know, you think, okay, you had half a day. But in actual fact, I only had a couple of minutes because they had to get through 50 other people who were also X-ray operating.
Wow.
Yeah. So we were not trained properly. Everybody, you know, has not been trained properly. So this 4,000 people they're saying they've got, they haven't been trained properly either.
So they don't know what they're doing. They don't know what they're looking at. And consequently, again, we go back to that idea, incompetence, anything could happen.
Yeah, and it's not their fault, you know, because they haven't, they don't, you don't, you know, if you haven't been trained for something, you don't know what you don't know, do you?
Of course, no, absolutely, I agree.
It's not their fault. It's, in actual fact, most of those X-ray operators I spoke to and were in my class were scared. They were terrified because they turned around to me and said, look, you know, we're missing basically major objects coming through. You know, I had to actually pretend to be a would-be terrorist. And I was given a knife, I was given a gun, and I was given this fake IED to go through. And the walkthrough metal detectors don't pick up the gun or the knife because there's not enough metal in them.
Mm-hmm.
The trainer said to me, look, here's a phone, here's some keys, go through again. And then it went off. The X-ray operator wasn't even looking at the bag with the IED in it. He then missed the gun go through, and he missed the knife go through. And I kept walking around and going through this PSA, what, for maybe an hour and a half, and so, you know, like 50, 60 times maybe. So every time I went through, they missed it. And in the end, I told them that I had something on me, that they had something in the bag, and they still couldn't see it.
Wow.
You know,
wow.
Now, you know, that's just, you know, really, you know, I had to flag that up. And, you know, I said to one of the trainers, I said, look, hey, you know, the walkthrough metal detector doesn't work properly. And how, you know, and all these, we were told that 350 people an hour were going to be coming through that PSA. And he said, well, don't worry about it, because during peak time, the metal detectors are going to be switched off anyway. And I went, what?
And he said,
yeah, detectors are going to be, and that was to our, that was to my class, by the way. It wasn't just to me personally. I asked the question to everybody. The metal detectors are going to be switched off during peak times. Now, with the military being brought in, with the more police being brought in, and these so-called students who can speak English being brought in, they've still not come out and said whether the metal detectors are going to be on or off during peak times. And also, there's something called, and this is particularly interesting for false flag sort of evidence, I suppose, or at least pointing towards that, is that what you've got a group of people that can get through the PSAs without being searched, and they're called internationally protected people. Now, I said, you know, what does that mean? As well, the trainers said, well, it's anybody who we've decided, i.e. the country, I guess, is an internationally protected status. So that could be anything from, say, like, you know, Obama would have that status, or David Cameron and other heads of state.
Yeah, they're not to be bothered with the security business, so leave them, basically, yeah.
But also, other people could have internationally protected, be an internationally protected person.
Yeah.
I said, oh, well, like who? And, well, he couldn't go into it, could he? But I said, like, you know, so basically anybody they want to get into the stadium without being searched is an internationally protected person. And he said, yes. And I went, oh, but someone could just be an internationally protected person and be the underpants bomber. And the guy laughed.
Well, I was just going to say that example, right? The well-dressed man comes and escorts him on the plane, no passports, no visa, no anything, just good to go, you know?
That's right. And all that would happen is that I was told that you would get a call on the radio about 5 minutes beforehand, and they'd say, an internationally protected person is going to be coming through your PSA. They're not to be touched. And that would be that. And they'd be escorted through.
Interesting.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. So, do you know how many of these metal detectors or entry gates, I guess, there were to be around the Olympic Park going into it?
No, I don't. But look, we were only sort of training, really. On you know, I hadn't got as far as being deployed, so you know, I was working on my PSA, and all I knew at the time was that I was going to be at the Olympic Stadium, And also, I could be at a local an Olympic stadium to me. You know, I live in Greenwich, so therefore, I also had I've been scheduled to work at North Greenwich Arena, which was called the O2. But because O2 is not sponsoring the Olympics, they're calling it the North Greenwich Arena. So I'm working there and in the Olympic Stadium. But there's loads of these PSAs everywhere. There's, you know, but the thing is that you're going to have to go through a PSA to get into the park in the first place. So that's going to be a hassle for people because, you know, there's going to be 80,000 people who are going to try and fit into the stadium in the morning. Then all those people, because you have a morning ticket and you have a sort of an afternoon ticket. Those people with the morning tickets, that's 80,000 people, are going to be in the stadium then. Then they have to leave. Another 80,000 people are going to come in for the afternoon. Plus, there's 100,000 people who are allowed into the park to watch it all on big screens. And I think they pay £10 or something, they said at the time.
Okay. Wow.
So these people are going to be going through the PSAs. So if you want to get into the Olympics stadium, you're going to have to turn up really early because the queues are going to be miles and miles long. So you have to have a PSA to get into the Olympics, the Olympic Park, and then the whichever venue you're going to, you'll go through another PSA and stuff. But the point is, if the metal detectors are being switched off anyway, they won't be working. What's the point? You might as well just open the gates and let people wander in.
Well, exactly. And that's a really good point because it's meant to be secure. It's meant to be very difficult, obviously, and everyone should be treated like a terrorist, right? Guilty, you know, until proven innocent kind of idea. So making it very, very difficult. But at the end of the day, all of these security measures, they seem to fail anyway. And then so what's even the reason for having the detectors there if you're not going to use them during peak times? I mean, it's ridiculous.
But it's theater. That's what it is. Security. You know, 90% of security is theater. That's why the pop stars have the big guys, you know, they have the 6-foot guy, you know, and all that kind of around them. But that's the deterrent, you know, in effect. You know, real terrorist cells or anything like that.
Give them the sense that they're secure, and then we've done our job. Because in their opinion, maybe they couldn't. They just realized that they couldn't protect from anything, everything anyway, so they don't bother. And instead, what you said before is that they just see this as an opportunity to make an extra couple of pounds on this anyway, or a couple of million, I guess.
And look, you know, these metal detectors, they're called Rapiscan metal detectors, are awful. You know, I don't know what kind of version that we had, but really, it didn't work anyway, even when they were switched on. You know, as far as I'm concerned, and I'm old fashioned this way, but a metal detector, surely, its basic function is to detect metal, right?
Yeah.
It didn't work. You had to have loads of metal on you. So basically, if you went with a 9mm, you know, handgun in your trousers, you'd wander through. The metal detector didn't go off, so therefore, you're not going to be searched. You're only going to be searched when the metal detector bleeps, right?
Mm.
And look for something. If the metal detectors are off, or they don't go off because the amount of metal that you've got in on you doesn't set them off, then you're not going to be searched. So I think that has been you can say that's deliberate because there are better metal detectors. I mean, there's a nightclub in London that has metal detectors to walk through before you get into the night, because actually they do have quite a lot of terrorist threats, not terrorist threats, but, you know, there was a gay club, and someone actually blew up quite a few gay pubs in London a few years ago. So they actually, you know, I suppose it's a terrorist, I guess, they actually do have real threats. They have to protect themselves. So, you know, that metal detector is better than the ones we had at the Olympics. Isn't that insane?
Yeah.
Now, it's just like, well, they're being cheap. They're saving money by getting the cheapest metal detector. But surely Rapiscan, the company who are supplying the metal detector, surely they should have said to them, hey, look, this isn't fit for purpose. This is the Olympics. You know, you need to have the super-duper one.
That's right. Yeah. You'd think, right?
Yeah.
Wow. So in your estimate here then, Ben, if we take all these things into account, you've been on the inside, you've seen some of this, you've obviously developed a hunch, you do have a background of knowledge about false flag attacks and everything else. So what, in your opinion, could happen? What's a possible or a couple of possible scenarios? I guess worst-case scenario and best-case, if you want to, then.
Okay, well, the worst-case scenario is that a dirty bomb, probably, which is already in the stadium, like the guy said.
Stop at that point. I got to repeat that again. He said, if there's something going off like a bomb, that's probably going to be part of what, the building, the infrastructure? Is that what he said?
It had factored into the system already. That's exactly how he said it.
Okay.
And I went, oh, so it's going to be built in then? And he went, oh, yeah, probably. But, you know, nothing for you to worry about.
Wow, yeah.
is that the Olympic stadium has got quite a lot of radioactive material in the ground, because it used to deal with a lot of radioactive material there. And the radioactive material that's in the ground is something called thorium that has a half-life of like 14 billion years or something crazy. It's really devastating stuff, this is. Now, they use this in nuclear power plants and stuff like that, because it's actually better than uranium. And there's quite a lot of experimentation, you know, for thorium power plants and stuff like that. So that's in the ground right now. And the thing about thorium is that it has an alpha particle that it emits. Now, if it's just in the ground, it can't actually penetrate through human skin. So everyone sits in the stadium is fine, right? It won't penetrate the skin. However, if a bomb were to go off, a fairly small size bomb, thorium has a property to it whereby it becomes a lot more explosive, and so it would increase the explosion, right?
Mm-hmm.
Also, that if that alpha particle would obviously be vaporized, it would then be aerosolized in a way. And that aerosol, in other words, it would appear in the cloud. That aerosolized particle would then be breathed in by everybody, and then it's devastating to human beings. You see liver problems, you see kidney problems. I mean, you die, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you don't die straight away, then you would have all these weird cancers appear in your body. And anyone who is exposed to that cloud will go all around London, go all up and down the country, go all around the world, really. Anyone exposed to that cloud, in theory, you know, would be dead, you know.
Wow.
So
yeah.
and would have a weird cancer. So that's the worst case scenario. The best case scenario, I suppose, is that they're just incompetent and they're out to steal money, you know. So we should actually be grateful if they're just robbing us of £300 million.
Yeah, well, still not something to be happy about, right?
Yeah, right, exactly. I mean, you know, the other day they had what was called a drill with the armed forces at a tube station in London. And they'd already had this drill, I think, twice before in the run, but they had it again the other day. And that was, again, you know, for a dirty bomb going off in the tube system. You know, not just a bomb, but a dirty bomb. So they had guys there in nuclear, biological, chemical warfare suits and stuff. And so, again, I thought, well, hold on a minute. Again, that could either just be practicing or you could be rehearsing for that. I don't have any other research on that, but that's what they did the day after we got the Olympics. You know, it worked once. You know, they don't tend to change their plans too often, do they?
That's true. Now, have you heard anybody else speaking about any kind of drill taking place before, during, or even slightly shortly after the Olympics, Ben?
Yeah, there was a drill in January that was reported. I'm not so sure whether this was reported. I mean, we actually all saw it. That's what we were seeing. We were seeing all the military aeroplanes and helicopters and stuff. I mean, it was scary because, it was a military event, you know. London now has been taken over completely. And what's interesting is that hasn't appeared in the paper yet. It might appear in the Telegraph or something next week or something before the Olympics opens, because that tends to be the modus operandi. And, of course, you know, the Telegraph being the paper of the MI6, you know, so that's how they get their things out. But also, you know, what we've got to look at is not just the fact that there's a possible false flag, is that why would there be a false flag? And in my opinion, it's because they want to go to war in Iran, and they want a precursor for that. And any attack on the Olympics isn't necessarily going to be an attack on the people of London or Great Britain. It's going to be seen as an attack on the world because, you know, the Olympics is all part of the new world order, you know, one world thing, you know, that they want to have going on. So it'd be an attack on the world, and so therefore the world, in theory, could respond to Iran. So that's why I believe that there would be a false flag. If there is going to be a false flag, it would be to try and get us into some sort of war with Iran. Because if they just sunk a ship, you know, that wouldn't necessarily get us in, would it?
Now, just speaking of that, I mean, the Iranians actually started out boycotting the games because of the interesting symbolism, the blatant Zion symbolism associated with the games. Now, what I've heard last is that they've filed a official complaint, I think, with the IOC or something like that. Consequently, nothing was done or whatever, and they're now decided to be in the games again. But again, interestingly enough, as you know, Ben, the Olympics has a history of Middle Eastern conflicts being drawn into it, like we go back to Munich in 1972 with Black September and everything else, Mossad being involved in the precursor to that event, stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's other people who know a lot more about this kind of, you know, stuff than I do. They go into a lot more detail about it and stuff. But, you know, the Olympics, you know, is really open for that this year. There's lots of, you know, all the signs are pointing to that something actually happening. And I'm not one of these alarmist people or anything like that, you know. I've worked with British agents who were employed by the British government to join the IRA. And what they would do is they'd get all these agents into the IRA, and then these agents would then train, you know, real IRA guys in, you know, how to make bombs, you know, how to really kill people and stuff like that. And one of these guys I spoke to actually got flown over to America by the FBI, taught how to set a bomb off using, you know, an infrared camera flash, and then brought that back and taught the rest of the IRA. So, you know, I know the modus operandi of these guys, and, you know, and if something wasn't going to happen, I'd be the first person to say, you know what, just G4S being incompetent. But you know what, incompetence is one thing, and stealing money is one thing, that's one side of it, but also things are being, the doors are being left open on purpose, I think, for, you know, a false flag. That's, and everyone seems to be saying the same sort of thing. Now, you know, is something going to happen? Possibly. I think because we've spoken about it, because we're bringing everything out into the light, I think we're actually making them change their plans right now.
Really?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I've had people calling me up and emailing me and what have you, who are telling me this, and these are people who are inside various, you know, intelligence agencies and stuff like that, who would know these things, and saying, look, you know, because what are you saying, you know, you're really causing trouble here, because, you know, they're having to change plans and stuff like that. Now, that's not necessarily saying there is a false flag. It just means to say that we're upsetting the apple cart for them.
An easier
time. Because, obviously, if the general public know that the security is bad to begin with, that the people weren't trained properly, that G4S had just stolen 300 million quid of their money, and then something happens, well, they're not going to believe the official story, are they?
That's true. But rarely anyway, Ben. The companies or anybody really who's supposed to be responsible never gets in trouble for these kinds of things. Same thing after 9/11 and the rest, you know, no arrests really. No one is like, you know, asked about these things.
Yeah, and of course, and there's no journalism anymore. So guess what? It will never come out. And it's up to the researchers in the researching community and you guys to actually do all the research and get out. You're the journalist now. That's the whole point. The major media, you know, it's a dying dinosaur, you know.
Yeah, it is.
But they're going to fight, aren't they, to keep their position for a while.
That's true, yeah.
Like all these people, you know, I got sent a message by my guy inside G4S, and he said, you know, the rats are leaving the ship, you know, kind of thing. And he seemed to think that G4S was actually, you know, because other countries are dropping contracts with them right now. They've got contracts in Australia, and the Australian government are dropping contracts with them. They've got contracts in America, people, companies are dropping, government or states are dropping contracts with them. Also, which is really good news for London and the UK, is because of what we're doing and what we've done, is that G4S now are not going to be in charge of the police in Surrey, and they are not going to be in charge of the police in the West Midlands, because they had the contract to run the backroom operations, which is the first step into the privatisation of the police.
Yeah, that's right.
In fact, they were saying to us during the course that they had more power than the police. And in fact, the police had nothing to do during the Olympics. They were doing it all, and the police were going to be bored, you know. So what's been really good news is that Surrey police have immediately just said, no, we don't want anything to do with G4S. And the Midlands, West Midlands police have said, no, we don't want anything to do with G4S as well. So I'm really glad that, if nothing else, what we've done is we've brought this company into the light. We've possibly stopped something going on at the Olympics. I mean, obviously, if it is war with Iran that they want to do, and plans are, you know, the Fifth Fleet's massed in Bahrain and everything's waiting to go, really, you know, they'll probably do it anyway because, you know, it's too late to stop it possibly. And then they'll, you know, this country will deal with the fallout, literally, as and when. But we've certainly stopped them from any privatisation plans, any future plans they had of taking over the police force in this country. And, you know, make no mistake, G4S, you know, is a global company. They wanted to have to be able to arrest you, they wanted to be able to take you to a G4S magistrate court, and not just to run the court, they actually wanted to be the magistrate. Then you were going to go to a G4S prison, that's run by G4S, so the governor of the prison would be a G4S guy. They wanted detecting powers, so to be detectives, and they wanted forensic powers. So,
the audacity, that's incredible.
They can't even run a sporting event for 4 weeks. What chances are they going to run all these things? You know, and what chances have we got as members of the public if we got picked up by a G4S character in a uniform? Do you think we'd have any hope of not going to jail? No, we're going to be going to jail because it's part of their bottom line. They're going to be making money every time they send someone to prison. So everybody they arrest are going to go to prison, of course. You know, and it's going to be massive miscarriages of justice. Anyway, yeah. We've seen all of that with G4S. In actual fact, one of the MPs today has said that they would like it if G4S were actually banned from having any, they couldn't tender for any public contracts ever again. And actually, that's great. So we've really done something here just by talking about it, which is really important.
Well, I hope you're right. And I also hope at the same time then that this means that they haven't at this stage turned the G-Force into a sacrificial lamb, meaning now to let it go out, it's going to go out with a bang instead of a whimper, if you know what I mean, Ben.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that was on the cards, definitely. You know, I certainly think that G4S, because, you know, Serco really is the favoured company. You know, and they run our nuclear weapons. They're in charge of nuclear weapons. They're in charge of all the airports. They've got all the infrastructure stuff, as well as running prisons and detention centres and stuff. So they could very easily just, you know, when they want to privatise the police, they could just step in. And actually, it was my theory that they wanted Serco to do that, but, you know, G4S were being promised all these things, and it was never going to happen because they were going to do something at the Olympics. We'd all blame G4S. G4S would go out of business, and Serco would then step in, you know, as well as the larger geopolitical, you know, things that were going on at the same time as well. And it's all just about, you know, clamping down on, you know, people of this country, you know, who pay for these Olympics as well. You know, we all know, you know, their intentions is to chip everybody in the world, isn't it? One government and all this kind of craziness, you know. And just by talking about it, just by shining a light onto these people, you know, we've not used any weapons or anything like that. We've not been violent, you know, and I hate all that kind of stuff when people said to me, oh, well, we should actually just start a war. Now, hold on a minute. You know, we don't do anything like that because all that we need to do is shine a light on these people. And, you know, you realise very quickly that they actually don't have any power whatsoever. They might be big and they might bluster a lot, but as soon as you shine a light on them, as soon as you get inside and you start delving deep into these companies, there's actually nothing to them because they've all been set up. They've all been just sort of handed these contracts and told to run it. So when someone actually criticises them, they actually don't know how to handle it. And they collapse very, very quickly. And that's what we're seeing now with G4S. And look, if little old me can have this effect on G4S. Just imagine what, you know, everybody, you know, who is awake could do if they put their mind to it, you know.
You're absolutely right. Now, Ben, before we begin to round things up here for this time, then, is there anything else you feel is important to get out to our friends and listeners around the world, and of course specifically those in England and around the London area listening? I mean, how far away from London are you going to be now here coming the 22nd of 27th of July?
Well, I'm leaving London for the 27th. You know, me and my family, we made a decision that we wouldn't be in London. You know, we're not going to take the risk. So, you know, just to be safe, you know, we're actually leaving. We're going to go and stay with friends far, far away from London. Mm-hmm. I live in Greenwich, so, you know, I can see the Olympic Stadium from where I live. So if it were to happen, we'd be one of the first people to be swamped with the thorium-radiated cloud. So, you know, the best thing to do for us is to leave London. I've heard a lot of people leaving London. You know, someone said to me that they were going on a day trip for the 27th. They'd leave very early in the morning, come back very late in the evening or perhaps even the next day. And so if anything happened, then they would at least be out of London for it. You know, really, the thing is, what we've got to make them do now is we've got to sort of make sure that these metal detectors are going to be turned on, that all the internationally protected people are going to be searched, no matter who they are. Look, you know, President Obama comes through your PSA, search him, you know. It doesn't matter. You do very politely, they can put their best army guy on it if they want. You know, let's have all that happen. Let's make sure that everybody who goes through there is searched and looked at properly. You know, I know the security services are doing their part. I know the army are doing their part above and beyond the call of duty, you know. But let's make sure that these PSAs are really safe, or safe as they possibly can be, and maybe even change the metal detectors themselves and get the better ones in there. You know, Rapiscan do a range of metal detectors. I can't see how hard it would be, because it's embarrassing for their company if something happens, because they'll be blamed as well. So they need to deliver better, you know, metal detectors and what have you. So if we can have these things, put pressure on them, and by putting pressure on them, we need to call the mainstream news organisations and hound, you know, these people into running the story, into acknowledging the fact that these things are taking place. And hopefully they'll then run a story about the metal detectors not being up to scratch, therefore they'll have to change the metal detectors, you know, and hounding MPs and stuff like that. So that's really what people of London need to do. And because, you know, it's not over until it's over. And we've really done something here. And it's people power that's done this, you know. We're not big organisations. We're all just very small, you know, we're just people who are part of small organisations, let's say, who manage to do something. I mean, I work for myself. I work on my own, you know, and then I try and, you know, place the stories that I work on with various news organisations and what have you. And then hopefully, I'm hoping to get paid at some point. Obviously, for this, that was never the case because, you know, I knew I probably wouldn't be, because they weren't going to run the story once I found that out. So that's what we do. And I know that other people have, you know, community radio stations and stuff, but we've already done something here. Now, if we can get the general public involved, if we can get everybody, you know, just questioning them, don't let them get away with anything. Don't let, if they just come out and say, no, everything's going to be fine. Boris Johnson said, he's the mayor of London, said, look, everyone's having pre-game jitters. These aren't pre-game jitters. These are major failings in the security, the front of house security arrangements at the Olympic Games.
Yeah.
Pre-game jitters is people being nervous. You know, the guy, you know, is on another planet, you know, literally. You know, and I'm amazed that people have re-elected him, really. But look what's going on. He needs to be better informed, you know, and people need to start saying to him, look, you know, make sure these people, you know, bring them to task. So I think people in London, really, and the UK in large, and there's some great people already doing a lot of work, I know that, on this very issue, but more people need to be involved. And really, we need to get rid of G4S completely, out of the games. And, you know, I'd even prefer the army to take over everything, quite frankly.
All right. Well, thank you for your time to them, Ben Fellows. We really appreciate it. And thanks you for being, you know, brave to do it and for taking the responsibility to do some quality control on this as well, that no one else have done, which is just amazing when you do think about it. Now, if there are any websites or other links or whatnot that you want to give out, please go ahead and do that, and we'll finish up on that note.
Okay, well, what's great is on the 25th of July, we're having Ian R. Crane and I will be presenting an Olympics, an emergency Olympics meeting in London at the, the Holiday Inn in Camden. And that's going to be a really exciting event, because Tony Gosling is going to be there, and everyone. And so if people want tickets for that, they can go to www.alternativeview.co.uk, and that event's going to be in London on the Wednesday, 25th of July, 7:30 p.m. And already lots of police are going to be there. Lots of media are actually going to be there, which is really great. I've been informed today. So that's a really special event. And if people want to get in contact with me, I now have a Facebook page, which I didn't before. they can contact me through my Facebook page. And if people want to see the evidence, because I know some people have said that, you know, oh, how do you know that you even work for G4S and stuff
right.
like that?
Right, yeah, yeah.
You know, they can have, you know, if you guys want to have a look at the evidence, I can give you all the evidence that I have. That, you know, pay slips and stuff where they're emailing me and documents that they've given me and all that kind of stuff that proves that, you know, I was there and saw and heard what I did. And, you know, even this, you know, argument I've had with Andy Davis, you know, all the documents are there. Because he actually ended up saying that he didn't know me at all. And, in fact, I have to prove that we've got emails going back 3 years. It's insane, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's great. And our friend Ian there as well, and Ian Crane having some activities in London on the 25th. We'll have that link up as well, alternativeview.co.uk. That's great. Thanks again, Ben. Take good care now, and we'll keep watching. We'll hope for the best, and we'll see what happens, huh?
Yeah, thank you ever so much for having me. You know, this has been really important to come and speak on this show. And let's cross our fingers. Let's hope for a great Olympics of sport. It is a sporting event, let's just not forget.
that's right. Easy to forget, huh?
Absolutely. I know it's our military games, but really it's a sporting event. So let's hope for some great sport. Let's hope for some great weather, because it's been raining here for weeks, you know.
Oh, wow, really?
It feels like November. It looks like November. It doesn't feel like summer.
Same here.
So let's hope for some great sport and cross our fingers and let's hope that nothing happens. And, you know, I wish everybody the very best, and let's just see how it evolves, let's say.